Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Mike Mutia, and today we're talking with Jehan about his book, Prophets and Prophecy in the Late Antique Near East. Jehan is an assistant professor in the Religious Studies Department at Brown University, and his work is comparative. And by comparative, I don't just mean that he looks at similarities and differences between Judaism and Christianity or Manichaeism or other religions in late antiquity. He does that, yes. But Jay wants us scholars of religion to think a little harder about how we habitually populate our worlds. Who talks to whom? Who reads what? We know that early Christians studied with and talked with Platonists and rhetoricians, but late antiquity is full of rich religious and philosophical traditions that too often get siloed. We know they exist, but we don't know what kind of impact they had on a wider society. We historians know that we should always historicize, but Jay wants to sharpen that. He says to historicize is to contextualize, that the comparisons we make shape the stories we tell. When we compare Christians with other Christians, we, consciously or not, think that late antiquity was filled with other Christians. Or maybe we compare the most famous Manichae-turned-Christian, Augustine of Hippo, and we, again, consciously or not, set up a hard line between Manichaeans and Christians, as if Augustine left some fringy cult and joined a universal homogeneous church full of men with blue blazers who took their kids to church on Sundays. And of course, that's not what happened. Or to say that differently, Tina Sessa asked us to keep late antiquity weird. Jay asked us to do that by making Manichaeism normal. Jay's book looks through the keyhole of Manichaeism to peek at late ancient religious, intellectual, and cultural lives. If Manichaeans were normal, that is, if people could recognize their rituals and ontologies and symbols and stories and writing styles, then what else might have been normal? And what might have been weird? So Jay, welcome. Thank you for being here. Can you introduce yourself? Who are you? How did you get interested in Manichaeans? And how did you come to write the book?
Sure. So thank you, Mike, for the invitation. And thank you to everyone who's listening to this right now. As Mike said, my name is Jehan. I'm an assistant professor in the Religious Studies Department and in the program for Judaic Studies here at Brown University. Who am I? I'm a scholar of religion. I think that's my disciplinary home. And I got interested in the study of religion when I was an undergraduate. My first year, I took a class with Elaine Pagels at Princeton. This was in 2005. And the course was called Early Christian Movement. And I think that was the only A that I got in that semester. And I thought, you know what, maybe this is my strength. Maybe there's a future here. But, you know, taking that class made me realize, you know, I really didn't know anything about the early church. I didn't really know anything about early Christianity. I had been raised in the church, but I realized that there was so much more diversity there that I just didn't, it wasn't even within the purview of my knowledge. I learned about Gnosticism. I learned about heresies. And then from there, I continued to work in religion. I learned Hebrew. And I actually went to get my master's in Jewish studies at Harvard Divinity School. And learning Hebrew and learning Aramaic, again, really kind of highlighted the limits of my knowledge about the ancient world and about the diversity of religions in that ancient world. When I started my PhD, I knew I generally wanted to start and talk about or think about this vague thing called Jewish-Christian relations, or the questions of when did or how did Judaism and Christianity part ways. And those were part of my starting set of questions when I began my PhD. But I was in one of my courses with my advisor, Annette Yoshiko-Reed, we started reading, I think it was the Cologne Mani Codex, and we'll talk a little bit more about this text later, but I remember being struck at how similar it felt to some of the rabbinic texts that I had been reading before, and how some of the ways that it tried to craft this narrative, how to make an argument, seemed to me certainly not identical to rabbinic texts, but similar enough to warrant some sort of comparison. And that was kind of the first beginning point of my interest in Manichaeism. Up to that point, you know, I didn't know anything about it. And I'm still learning about it. And, you know, sometimes when I go to different campuses, I ask graduate students, like, where are you learning about Manichaeism? How are you learning about it? What do you think about it? You know, do you think it's a Christianity? Do you think it's a Gnosticism or whatever term you're going to use? I'm still kind of stuck with the Manichaean text. Eventually, I want to move beyond it, but you know, I'm stuck in it because there seems to be so much work to be done. Maybe I'll just stop there. Oh wait, and how did I come to write this book? You know, that's essentially how it grew out of learning more about Manichaean texts, being exposed to the Pseudo Clementine homilies, which is also a somewhat of an important, you know, text in the book, and trying to make them coherent and relevant to one another. I think that was where the challenge came in. One thing led to another, and yeah, I'll just stop there. I feel like I just keep talking on.
Yeah. No, that's great. Thank you. And I think it really helps us both contextualize the book and like how you came to write it. Like you said, you go to graduate students and you ask them, you know, what is Manichaeism? And you probably get, feigned looks of just like, I should know about this, but I don't really. Because in like popular culture, the only time you hear the word Manichae is to mean something like dualistic or somebody with some like rigid standard of right and wrong, right? So let's see if we can kind of set this up a little bit, right? Mani, he lives in the 3rd century in Persia. Manichaeism in late antiquity was huge, right? It went from like Britain all the way to China, goes all throughout the Roman Empire, all throughout Sasanian Persia. So it was everywhere. But can you tell us briefly, you know, who was Mani? What do we know about his earliest followers? And can you give us some kind of orienting basics around the sources for Manichaeism?
Right, sure. I guess this is not a funny story. Perhaps it's a depressing story. I gave a talk maybe last week to a bunch of undergraduates, and you know, they're wonderful undergraduates, you know, they're very smart and all this kind of stuff. And I briefly mentioned that word Manichaeism or Manichaean dualism, and I said, Do you know this word? And none of them raised their hands. I'm like, you never heard the word Manichaean dualism? I don't know. Maybe this is an indictment. I said, You all need to read more. You know, that was like, you need to read more if you haven't come across this phrase yet. They're wonderful. So I just want to say that story. Okay, so who was Mani? Already we kind of get into a question, right? I have to recommend Ian Gardner's recent book, Mani, the Founder of Manichaeism, I think that's what it's called, in which he kind of deconstructs, you know, some of the more popular understandings of who the historical Mani was, which is a thing that we still need to do. No one looks at, you need to have critical criteria when you read something like the Synoptic Gospels to try to get back to the historical Jesus. Similarly, one needs to have the same kind of set of critical eyes to try to get back to the historical Mani. So what I'm going to say right now is going to kind of sound as pretty hagiographical, but a lot of it is coming out of this text that I mentioned already, the Koine Mani Codex. And essentially what that text tells us, supplemented with other texts, is that Mani seems to have been born in the early 3rd century CE, somewhere in close to the vicinity of Ctesiphon, which is or was the capital, depending on how you use that word, of the Sasanian Persian Empire, which was really emerging in force in the 3rd century CE. And what this text tells us, the Koine Mani Codex, what it tells us is that Mani was born into a community that prioritized the practice of ritual baptism and food separation. But throughout Mani's youth, he seems to be having these visions seeing angels of power. And eventually these visions culminate in the appearance of his Suzugos, his twin, perhaps Talma in Aramaic, in which his twin talks to Mani and then they unify. And then from then on, Mani recognizes who he really is. That is, he's the apostle of Jesus Christ to this generation. And since the moment of his unification with his twin, he begins to oppose the practices of baptism and food separation that his community followed, and he was promptly expelled. And then he began to wander across the newly established Sasanian Empire, and preaching the gospel, you know, or his gospel, or what he imagines to be the gospel. And he was actually quite successful. He seems to have he established communities all the way in Edessa, which will become very important for the emergence of what we call Syriac Christianity. And he seems to have found supporters within the Sasanian court as well. But, you know, once you're in the Sasanian court, you're also could also be targeted. And it seems that there was a Zoroastrian head priest, famous priest by the name of Kartir, who instigated some sort of suspicions against Mani, and Mani was eventually executed. And he died he was martyred in the late 3rd century CE. What we know about his earliest followers is not a lot, because what we need to know, what we can reconstruct about his earliest followers needs to be done on the basis of, you know, the texts that we have from them. And for the most part, they're largely anonymous. We do know that Mani had a successor, Sisinios, and then Sisinios had another successor named Inaios. But for the most part, the vast majority of Manichaean churches that Mani had established throughout Sasanian Mesopotamia, we know very little about them. And it's only, I think, recently, again, Ian Gardner has edited an edition of Mani's epistles, which I highly recommend everyone to look through. And I think reading those epistles critically will get a firmer historical grounding for what the emergence of the Manichaean church actually looked like. So that's one way of kind of, I guess, deflecting the question. We don't know a lot, but the opportunity is there. For the sources that we have and the sources that we talk about, especially for the Manichaean in the book, at least in my book, at least, I really have to stress that I'm really looking at the works that were found in Roman Egypt. So the works that just happened to have made it to Roman Egypt. So works that begin from Mesopotamia and go westward. There are many, many texts from Mesopotamia that go eastward towards China that I'm simply not equipped to address. I want to learn all these languages, but, you know, I just don't have the time. And I try repeatedly, but I never, you know, I can't master it. But some of the texts that were discovered in Egypt, and for one reason or another, has not had the same impact for the study of Christianity that something like the Nag Hammadi codices or the Dead Sea Scrolls had for the study of Judaism and Christianity, are these codices that were found in Egypt. And they are quite monumental. Many of them are in very poor condition because of war and of storage and all this kind of stuff. But these texts that were found in Egypt, they include things like there's a Sunaxis that was discovered. There was a psalm book, a criminally understudied Manichaean psalm book that I don't know how to use this as this podcast as a recruiting thing, but, you know, I encourage everyone to read through it. Yes, it's in Coptic, so learn Coptic, okay? You know, that's what one does. There's a psalm book, there's the homilies. There were these two massive codices of the Kephalia. The first Kephalia is called the Kephalia of the Teacher. And the second half of the same volume is called the Kephalia of the Wisdom of My Lord Mani. The first Kephalia was fully edited. I believe the editing is completely done. The Kephalia of the Wisdom of My Lord Mani, that is the second Kephalia, work is ongoing. And we're really eagerly looking forward to the addition of the next volume. The first volume has already been published, but we're really looking forward to the next volume. I believe that team who's working on it is Jason Badoon, Paul Dilley, and Ian Gardner, I believe. There's other texts. There was a book of Mani's epistles that I just mentioned, and there's also the Koan Mani Codex, which was not found in the same area as the other seven codices. And it's the only text in Greek that we have that was written by Manichaeans. But very clearly, if you know your Aramaic and if you know Greek, you can tell quite clearly that this Koan Mani Codex was actually translated from Aramaic. And I think we had to kind of keep the translation where it was discovered, Egypt, in mind. And also we had to keep in mind the possible Aramaic or Greek forlaga to these texts. So one, in a way, one reads in Greek or one reads in Coptic, but one thinks perhaps in Aramaic when situating it in Mesopotamia, especially. Yeah. I think I'll just stop there.
No. That's really helpful. There, you know, just trying to get some sense of, you know, who Mani is, where he's from, what his earliest followers are like, and then these sources, like you were saying, they're all over the place. You know, people working in Manichaeism are working in 7, 8, 9 languages. You're being modest here, but your book is working in 5 or 6 languages, I'm sure. I stopped counting at some point, but you know, and just to kind of recap, until the early 20th century, most of what we understood about Manichaeism came from what people were saying about Manichaeism, right? And then there's these discoveries of these different manuscripts that you're looking at have really, you know, shed light on what Manichaeism might have actually been like. So, you know, part of your recruitment program here is the fact that there actually are these new texts that we keep finding, and there's real work to be done here. So it's great. And the other thing that your book, I think, really helps us see is just how diverse, both linguistically and religiously, the world of late antiquity was, right? You really make a point to show that the center of gravity in late antiquity is not the Roman Empire, the Mediterranean, but it's Mesopotamia. That, you know, Mani grows up in Sasanian Persia, which was probably the like most cosmopolitan place on earth at the time, right? And to study these texts requires, you know, learning all these different languages. But you're showing us that, you know, even if, you know, for some people we think of Christianity as kind of the dominant religion of the Roman Empire, when you start with Manichaeism, when you kind of make that the center point, then you show, one, in the 3rd and 4th centuries, Christians were at best one of many religious groups. And two, even in places where they were dominant, they shared a kind of imaginary and a set of habits with the other groups that they lived with and traded with and married into and fought against and borrowed from, right? And that's, I think, a big part of your book, saying, look, we need to contextualize this world with lots of different groups. So can you tell us more about what you mean by contextualization and kind of how you thought about the kinds of comparisons that would help us understand this world of late antiquity?
Right. A lot of my thinking in this regard comes from my flirtation with intellectual history, and thinking, you know, seriously about what is a context, and how do contexts acquire the force of truth? Mm. How do they acquire the effect of being something real? And I think one of the ways that I try to think about it was try to distinguish between background and context. So, for example, we can say something like the Apostle Paul, right? The letters of Apostle Paul. You know, in order to understand the Apostle Paul, you have to understand the Roman Empire. Right? That's a given, of course. Like, who could argue with that statement, right? It's the same thing with the Sasanian, with the Mesopotamia, the Manichaean movement. Oh, in order to understand the Manichaean movement, one needs to have a working knowledge of the Sasanian Empire. Of course, that's true. Okay, but what that does already is it kind of foregrounds a text and it backgrounds the, I don't want to call it a hypostasis, but it's like this thing behind the text that supposedly just invests the foregrounded text with all of its meaning, all of its significance, and all this kind of stuff. And I'm suspicious of that foreground background kind of analysis. What I think is more important and perhaps more interesting and more with a greater potential for re-describing or re-narrating is to put text on a shared plane of analysis. And that is what I mean by contextualization. So whereas a background, we foreground and we background, foreground a text, we background a milieu or a culture or whatever, I see contextualization as a scholarly practice. Contextualization is putting a text and putting another text right next to it and saying something interesting from those two texts. And one, of course, needs a category, or one kind of needs a keyhole or a scope or a key to kind of make these two texts interesting. But contexts really are, for me, something that scholars make in order to say something interesting or plausible or even true about the text or a phenomenon that one is interested in looking at. And in that sense, context for me has no boundaries. these boundaries that that we kind of think about, oh, you know, I'm going to study Manichaeans and I'm going to study Manichaean texts. It's like, okay, or I'm going to study Manichaeism. I'm just a little bit suspicious of any kind of outside, not outside, but any kind of delimiting of scholarly creativity, if that makes sense. I'm actually for, I want people to go with text. I want them to kind of go as far as they can to see where relevance begins to break down, where plausibility begins to break down, and see, you know, in a way, perhaps experimental, but perhaps a little bit ironic, to show where, kind of reflect back on how scholars imagine relevance, how it emerges. I think we should have, you know, frank conversations about why one text is considered not relevant for another text. And sometimes in my kind of more, mischievous or, mentality, I think maybe what we should prioritize is actually comparison first and foremost. You know, we say something like, the late antique Roman Empire, and we put all the texts that we can find that is in late antique Roman Empire, or even delimiting further to late antique Syria or whatever, we put all the texts that we have from that period. And then we tell our students, or we ask ourselves, okay, say something interesting about this motley assortment of texts. And in that sense, I feel like there's more creativity that could be done. I want to see scholarly creativity go as far as it can go, essentially, until it begins to break down.
Yeah. That's great. And I think one way that we see the kind of a helpful breakdown of categories is your insistence that we shift. I mean, the book is not called Religions in the Late Antique Near East. It's called Prophecy. But the book, it revolves around prophecy and revelation rather than religion. So can you tell us what we see with prophecy and religion prophecy and revelation that we might miss with religion?
Yeah. So I have to admit in the beginning, so, you know, well, the readers or the listeners here might know there's skirmishes that becomes battles about the category of religion and its applicability into, you know, the period prior to the emergence of religion, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's a very important conversation to have, but it's a conversation that doesn't necessarily help me. For me, it comes down to maybe this is a neo-pragmatic kind of approach, like, you know, what is the utility? Like, what do you want to say? What do you want to argue, right? And is the category of religion helpful in this regard, or is it an impediment? And for me, I was trying to think about, well, you know, if I were to write a book on, for example, revelation in rabbinic literature, or revelation in, late antique Christian literature, or whatever, I couldn't imagine it being an interesting book. No offense, I just couldn't imagine it being all that interesting because I think it's delimited, A, and B, it would feel more, the book would feel more like a summary or a description of things within an archive, as opposed to something that could be more creative by placing these texts that have not been juxtaposed to one another. And again, trying to use our scholarly creativity to kind of put these things in conversation with one another that cut across religious lines. I also think that in a way, religion has a tendency to, it's too clunky for me. It was too cumbersome of a category to be useful. And what I wanted to do was disaggregate it into manageable units. And for me, they were specific texts. Now, at the end of the day, you know, you and I or any historian, if we want to have a epistemic grounding in the ancient world, it needs to come back to text or artifacts or materials that we are essentially interpreting or trying to say something new. In my mind, I felt like something interesting could be said, for example, by comparing something like, you know, oral Torah in rabbinic literature and oral revelation in the Kephalia, the Manichaean Kephalia, than to say, okay, well, these are kind of two unrelated phenomena, right? So in a way, I guess one can say religion helps us see the divide in the first place, but that divide doesn't have to delimit the ways that we actually do our work.
Great.
That's how I would put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So so much of this book is about kind of like world building. Like, what does this world look like if we start from Manichaeism? But part of that world building involves like a little bit of demolition. What's a kind of myth that you're helping to bust about Manichees and their world? The first couple chapters are taking a look at some misconceptions that we might have about Manichees in their kind of early days. Can you lay that out for us?
Sure. I think the first thing would be to conflate something like the Manichaean songbook or the Kephalia with, oh, this is what the historical Mani said, right? That's not, I mean, in no other kind of critical field would that be acceptable, right? It's like, no, Mani didn't say this, right? It's a text that says that Mani said it, and one needs to look at the text, and whether Mani actually said it needs to be a separate line of inquiry, right? This is kind of obvious, but so many times you hear, you know, people saying, oh, this is what Mani actually said. It's like, no, you know, be critical. Okay, no, maybe he did, but you have to argue for that. I think that's number one. Number two is that these Manichaeans are somehow just like hanging out in some dark and dusty, quote unquote, Gnostic corner of the world, just waiting to be used by these Orthodox Christians, quote unquote, Orthodox Christians, for their own self, you know, for their self creation of orthodoxy or whatever, right? No, Manichaeans are not some like two-bit actors, you know, they're not. I don't know if that phrase is normal. Anyways, you know, they're not just some like weirdos, you know, hanging out, you know, in the attic or something. You know, they are actively a part of the late antique world. And why would we expect otherwise, you know? And they need to be placed in conversation with them. And, you know, this is one of the things that I try to do, at least in chapter two, you know, the idea that Ephraim is responding to a prior Manichaean idea, right? He might very well be. But we can flip the direction too. We can say, no, what if Manichaeans are actually responding to people like Ephraim? What if Manichaeans are responding to, you know, liturgies about Paul and Thecla, as we clearly see in the Manichaean songbook, right? So it's a way of kind of bringing the Manichaeans back into the conversation. And I do want to stress that the sheer utility, the untapped utility for the Manichaean text for critical scholars and creative scholars to begin to incorporate these texts, you know, I said the criminally understudied songbook, to bring them to normalize these texts within their fields of inquiry. That's really what I kind of want to push at least in terms of the Manichaeans, right? Just one more thing, I would say it's the potential to tell different and interesting stories about Christianity as well. I'm one of those. It's difficult to tell because we can't read people's minds, but you know, for the most part, I get a sense that most scholars of late antique Christianity still think that Manichaeans are like their own separate religion. But if you read some of the Psalms, you know, or if you read how Mani's talking about Jesus, I brought you into the church in Jesus's name. It's really kind of hard to escape the sense that, like it or not, Manichaeism, at least in Mesopotamia, is Christianity. We can talk about all these categories, especially in inscriptions of Kartir. We can talk about those things later if one wants to, but I mean, even if one doesn't say that Manichaeism is Christianity, the fact that Manichaean literature is filled with Jesus Christ, right, means that one still needs to engage with this literature if one is interested in, for example, the earliest flowering of Christianity in Mesopotamia. There's simply no escape. So I think the critical kind of incorporation of Manichaean texts into the study of Christianity and the kind of new platforms or new vantage points that it affords I think that has not been nearly, it hasn't been tapped nearly enough. And there's a lot more work that can be done. Yeah.
I mean, I think if you played like, you know, Manichaean or Christian with those psalms, I would definitely get a few of them wrong. It's hard to tell. And whether that makes them Christians or not is probably a different kind of question, but the similarities are striking. Let me try to keep us like on contextualization. As I was reading the first two chapters of the book, I was thinking these are kind of two different approaches that you're using. One is a kind of inside-out approach, and the other is a kind of outside-in approach. So with the first chapter, you're looking at the Kol Mani Codex, and you're trying to say, when we read this closely, we can get some sense of this Baptist or baptizing community that Mani was a part of and kind of his earliest followers. So can you tell us kind of how you tease that out? How do we go from this text? What are you seeing in it? And then what kind of community are you imagining as you're reading this text?
Sure. That's a great question. So I think the first thing we need to do conceptually is to kind of bracket the question whether this Baptist movement and the Manichaean movement are always separate things or distinguished things. And here I feel like the incorporation of Ian Gardner's kind of edition of the epistles could add further weight to what I'm trying to do. But regardless, in the same way that, you know, scholars now, at least in late antique Christianity, don't necessarily think that Jew and Christian meant and always meant two separate categories, right? In the same way, Baptist and Manichaean might not always have been two separate categories, right? So in a way, what we need to do is, okay, well, let's assume that that will be a trajectory. Okay, but ask then, well, how does that differentiation actually come about? And do we actually see it in this particular text? I'm reminded of, you know, of, I can't unthink, you know, because I was with Annette as my advisor, I can't unthink the ways that, you know, the ways that she's helped me to see things, right? But we claim to make global claims, like, you know, Baptists and Manichaeans were always separate. But in fact, what we have are local texts, right? What we have are specific texts that tell us maybe something about a local context. So I just want to stress that. So we bracket the question of Baptist-Manichaean binary, and then we read the text and try to understand what's going on there. And what I see, at least in the Kol Mani Codex, is an argument that needs to be made after Mani's death, because in a way that I see it, there were still people, even despite Mani's own kind of claims to the contrary in his own books, there were still people who, in a way, remembered Mani as a person who grew up in this Baptist community for much of his early life. And even despite Mani's claims that, no, you know, God chose me from before I was born, very much like Paul, by the way, God chose me before I was born to become the apostle of Jesus Christ. Despite that, it's very difficult. I think it was very difficult for certain communities of Baptist teachers to accept Mani's claim to be utterly different from them. And this is visible because even when one tries to see where Mani is distinguishing himself from the Baptists, kind of like a good Derridaean, you could kind of be like, well, maybe the opposite is actually inside too. You know, like how much of Mani's thinking is actually indebted to his Baptist upbringing, right? And try to see it that way. And more specifically, when I'm talking about the homily of Barais, maybe it's Bar Haya in Aramaic, but Barais is talking against an opponent that he spends a lot of time and intellectual labor arguing against. And in a way, that kind of intensity, for me, highlights intimacy. It doesn't highlight already separation. It highlights, no, I actually care that enough about what you're saying in order to respond to you in full. And what's so striking to me about this homily is that the way that he argues is by saying that, no, Mani is a traditional prophet, a traditional apostle in the mode of all the other ancestral apostles. right? Apostle Adam, Enoch, Paul, whomever, right? But in order for that argument to work, logically, it means that Barais's opponents also understood Adam, Sethel, Enoch, Sethel to have been their ancestors as well. The only thing that's the point of schism is whether Mani fits in it or not. And of course, Barais is saying, yes, he does fit. And he thinks that he has a right to actually adjudicate what traditional prophethood actually looks like, right? And whereas his opponents say that, no, he doesn't fit. And I mean, I could talk a lot more about it, but what's so striking about that argument is that, in a way, it requires a shared ancestry between Barais and his opponents, which for me seems to indicate, or one can make a plausible argument at least, to say that actually these are members of the same community, actually bitterly divided about the location of Mani within their community's history. And what's so interesting about this homily, and I'll stop here, is that it comes right after the scene in which Mani is unified with his twin, as in the redactor of the Kolon Mani Codex, which is not a straight literary composition, but in fact an anthologized a narrative. There's an anonymous redactor who had discrete narrative chunks, and he ordered them in such a way to tell a long, coherent story about the life of Mani. Is that this homily is just a redactor placed this homily right after the time Mani's connection, unification with his twin, as if to warn the reader, don't be like the people who are misinterpreting what I just wrote. That is, you know, but you have to see it the way that Barais put it. And the way that he put it in fact, it radically disrupts the narrative flow. You know, it's like it radically disrupts it, meaning that the redactor was very intentional about putting this homily right here so that you don't get things confused, right? But if he's worried that you're going to get confused, it means that other people, according to him, are confused, right? About Mani's location within this kind of Baptist community. So I'll just stop there. Yeah.
That's really helpful. So if you read it one way, this is, you know, the story of the life of Mani and some of his teachings. But with a kind of closer eye that you're taking us, you're showing, no, this is a text written after Mani. And what we can really see is a kind of succession fight going on. That Mani's gone. And the question is like, well, what do we do now? And we can see this kind of, I don't know, like that these categories of prophecy, that they're legitimating this new community that's going to end up kind of taking control, this kind of like scholastic community that ends up looking a lot like the rabbis, just down the road, right? That's great. And the other way, so the one way is kind of the inside out, the kind of close reading that then lets you kind of zoom out and see a world. In the next chapter, you kind of go the other way, and you show kind of looking at the Kephalion, the chapter book of the teacher, how it's sharing all of these other kind of patterns with rabbis and with Ephraim, the Syrian 4th century Christian Syriac poet, and how it has this kind of diffuse growing structure that sounds or at least resonates with kind of other things going on in Sasanian Persia. So can you kind of talk to us about how the Kephalia, this chapter book, gets illuminated when we put it in this kind of Jewish Christian Persian context?
I mean, the Kephalia, in that chapter, I have three sets of what I call like contextualizing ventures. And there, the goal is to normalize this really kind of expansive text and to try to show, again, the utility of it. For scholars who are interested in rabbinics, for scholars who are interested in Syriac Christianity or Christianity generally, the Sasanian Empire as a whole as well. Because, of course, this text is, I think it's relevant for all three. For instance, for the second part of that chapter, I try to show that this kind of classic idea that, you know, the Manichaeans believed in this kind of notion of a chain of prophets. If you actually look at the text itself, And if you try to undo its seams, in fact, when one reads the Kephalaya, I've written elsewhere, you know, the Kephalaya kind of insists on showing its bones. Like, it's not a smooth literary composition. And when one reads it carefully, one can see redactional errors not pretty much everywhere, but you can see it quite often. And it's very clear that the long process of anthologization and redaction went behind the production of this text. And in that way, I think that kind of anthological impulse, it kind of showcases its wide, diffuse applicability of what might be relevant and what might not be relevant. So, for example, just in the front part of the first Kephalion, right, there is the classic notion of this Manichaean chain of prophets. But as I argue there, that chapter is not interested in the chain of prophets, right? That chapter is worried because it wants to account for all of historical time, right? The chain of prophets is merely a tool, a rhetorical tool for trying to account for the entire stretch of time from Adam all the way to Mani, right? And when one tries to kind of put these things together, it feels very, very cumbersome, And what is most important in that chapter, at least what I argue, is that it really wants to say that Mani had to come precisely when he did, right? The real point of Mani, that he had to come precisely when he did. He couldn't have come before, right? He couldn't come afterward. He came exactly when he meant to. And why would Manichaeans, again, writing in the late 3rd to the mid 4th century, be concerned with this notion that Mani had to come exactly when he did? Well, as I argue, because there's these kind of growing discourse that Manichaeism can't be real because Mani was too late, right? Mani was too tardy, right? In a way, this chapter, what it's trying to do, as I argue, is trying to kind of reverse that and say, no, Mani wasn't late. He was just the last, right? In fact, the last has a priority because Mani's going to stay here. The Mani's church, not Mani. Mani's ascended, right? The Manichaean church is actually going to persist until Jesus comes back, right? And that's just one way of kind of thinking about the applicability of Manichaeism, about the Kephalaya into Syriac Christianity. I do something similarly with a comparison between a Sasanian inscriptions and a specific Kephalion in the second Kephalaya, that is a Kephalaya, the Wisdom of My Lord Mani. And I also look at the introduction of the Kephalaya, which is, I think, fascinating, just because, as I try to argue, it's doing something that all introductions do, right? That is, it's trying to frame what comes afterwards. It's trying to introduce a reader to how to understand correctly and shape the reader's experience of what comes afterwards. And there, that anxiety seems to be, as I argue, right? That anxiety is, don't read what follows as if they're isolated units of revelation. What they are actually contiguous units of revelation. They all belong together in a certain way. I'll stop there, but that's,
yeah,
there's a lot that one can say.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. And you're getting us into Revelation, which is the second half of the book. And that's great. So one kind of commonality that you point to in the second half of the book is this prioritization of speech. And, you know, listeners might be familiar with, you know, Plato's famous critique of writing, but late antiquity is this great age of written texts that come to define religions, right? And Mani, he critiques other religious leaders like Jesus or Buddha for not writing down their teachings. Like, this is what he does. It's better than the other ones, right? But late antiquity, it's this time of great bookishness, right? Like, literally, it's like the beginning of the Codex, like not a scroll, but a book that you can flip through. But also, you know, the New Testament canon, the Talmud, the Quran is going to call Christianity and Judaism religions of the book. And more broadly, I'm thinking about, you know, Glenn Bowerstock's argument for why late antiquity should be considered its own time period. And his argument is largely that this is the time where major texts and educational curriculum and creeds and liturgies and laws, that these things are all getting codified at this time, right? It's this time of encyclopedic knowledge. And I think you agree with all of that, right? You're not really disagreeing there, but you're saying, also, at the same time as this kind of, you know, great bookishness, this kind of big codification is happening, we get the oral Torah and we get the sayings of the desert fathers and mothers. We're getting the pseudo-Clementine homilies, which are all these kind of oral performances, right? And so if I'm reading you right, you're not trying to say, you know, like one influences the other, like who knows what. But to contextualize this, you're trying to set up a kind of shared imaginary, a shared set of expectations, or what you call a common fund of discursive options and strategies available to a range of late ancient people living in between the Roman Near East and Sasanian Persia. So when we look at Manichaeans as weird, oral Torah looks unique. When we think of Manichaeans as normal, then we can see how Christians and Jews and Manichaeans, they're all developing this emphasis on the oral around the same time as they're codifying and expanding, right? These things are actually happening all at the same time. And so, you know, why then at this time of great bookishness do you think that the oral becomes consciously prioritized? And what is comparing then, you know, oral Torah and Manichaean text help us see about revelation in late antiquity?
So those are a lot of really great texts. I mean, questions. Those are really great questions. And in a way, they kind of go beyond my book. But they're great questions. I think maybe the first thing that I will say, and this is not part of my book, but this is just a suspicion that I'm starting to. I'm reading other scholars who are going along these lines, and I'm like, oh, I think what they're saying is actually very interesting. Maybe one of the things that we've ignored to our detriment is that, you know, yes, it is a period of bookishness, but the book seems to be at the end of a long process of other textualizing ventures. In a way, the book isn't just, the book is the finished product, right? What came before that book, right? The drafts, right? The Hupomenemata or something like that, right? The conversations that must have had between people before the book happened. And for some reason or another, how come we don't consider those things, which are largely opaque to us, but which I think more recently scholars are starting to get a handle on, how come we don't consider those little bits as part of the textuality of the late antique Near East? And here I'm thinking about Monica Amster's recent book on the Babylonian Talmud, in which she kind of really emphasizes this kind of the material, discrete material strategies of data management, essentially in the late antique world, you know, things that were written on papyrus, on like fragments of like potsherds or on bone or pieces of wood, right? Those are discrete pieces of text, but they're not folded into our conceptualizations of, typically they're not folded into our conceptualizations of late antique textuality, right? And, you know, I'm reminded there's a graduate student in the classics department here that Mike, you know, that we know, right? Ella Kirsch, and she's writing about transcriptions, as a technical art that develops within a historical time period, and you know, we don't really have a lot of the. I don't know. I got to read the dissertation, but the way that she presents it, yeah, there seems to be this wide range of taking shorthand, right? That is not incorporated into our understanding of textuality. It's the same thing with you know, with the Gospels as well. You know, there seems to have been drafts and certain expectations that certain genres or of textualities that they are opened in a way to further rearrangement, further editing, further redaction. And in that way, I kind of want to draw focus, although I don't do this in my book, I think that's where we're kind of starting to move. Like we're expanding our understanding of textuality. Yes, the book becomes very important, but in order for the book to become very important, everything that came before must also rise in importance as well. And in a way, this is all already captured, at least in the introduction to Kephaliah, because I think the Kephaliah, the introduction there, its conceit and its desire is to be a book that sits on the same shelf with Mani's books, others Mani's books. The Talos is still Mani's written revelation. Right, which is why it says this is the oral revelation that was not contained in Mani's books, which what makes you want to think that this is a natural oral complement to Mani's books and therefore should belong into the canon, right, into the canon of Manichaean text. But that's just the introduction. When one actually kind of reads through the kind of textuality of when kind of tries to understand what the individual Kephaliah are about, I think what we are getting at is a sort of textuality, again, very similar to rabbinic literature, in which the importance is not so much on the surface of the text. The importance of it is on the performance of the text, right? As I try to argue elsewhere, I think the kephalaya functions more as notes for a performance that we should not confuse with the performance itself, which is why it's okay that it has such sloppy editing at times, right? In which different units are being just kind of like foisted in from other places and to try to frame a rhetorical whole, essentially. So I wonder to what extent both rabbinic literature, and here I feel much, because I'm not a rabbinicist, but, you know, I try to read up on what's going on there and Manichaean stuff as well. I wonder to what extent that the peculiar signature, literary signature, of both rabbinic literature and the kephalaya, if it's not self-consciously trying to tell the readers, and here I have readers in scare quotes, because, you know, these are, they're read, but, you know, whether question of oral Torah, if it was read, you know, that's not, I don't want to touch that. If there's not this kind of self-conscious way that they're being textualized, as if to remind the reader that we are incomplete, that we are not the finished product, which is an invitation for the reader or to add to it, to continue with it. Because if it is a literary composition with a front and the end, then we're done. Then we're done. There's nothing more to add. And I know I'm being a little bit crude in that last point, but really, I think the genre and the literary signature of both of rabbinic literature and the kephalaya screens out and say, we're not done, complete us. And of course, revelation never ends. So it kind of builds on and on and on and on. Yeah, so that's the way that I'm trying to begin to think about this. But really, I'm just starting to think about this in a more interesting way. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense. I think it made sense. Yeah, and I think you're showing us how these, seemingly bounded texts, that they are tools or invitations into a certain kind of learning community. And you talk about this in terms of these kind of like intense face-to-face relationships, that is like the shape of this reading community. And you trace those kind of face-to-face, you know, like, let's all sit with these texts together in Manichaean texts, in Christian texts, in Jewish texts. And you also then in the next chapter lead us to start with Iamblichus and to other kinds of Neoplatonist thinking. And you show how kind of with the intensity of these relationships in mind, there's this kind of knowledge that becomes increasingly important that isn't about revealing like this or that thing. Like, it's not like, you know, prophecy that a flood is going to come tomorrow or that empire is going to fall. But there's this kind of bigger knowledge. You quote Peter Strzok, you say that it's a kind of knowledge that encompasses the deepest secrets of the structures of the cosmos and the human place in it. But you're showing us how philosophers like Iamblichus, Christians, Manichaeans, they talk about this idea of prognosis. Prognosis sounds like a medical word, like as a doctor telling you how a disease will progress. But what it meant in Greek for these people was, it's more like a movie that kind of sucks you into another world, right? That for Iamblichus, prognosis is divine. It's got a logic of its own that can't be reduced to other ways of knowing. And that takes a certain kind of community to get you into that other sphere, right? So, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on Iamblichus there, but, you know, how did he think about this new way of knowing? And you know, how does what we see in Iamblichus with prognosis help us understand Christian and Manichaeans thinking about that same kind of shift in sphere?
Great. Yeah. So great. You know, again, great questions. I guess it depends. So I, thanks, Mike, because I'm assuming that you're convinced by my arguments. You know, maybe I know other people might be like, oh, maybe Jay's stretching the evidence too far. You know what? Whatever. You know, whatever, you know, let's stretch it to as far as we can, as I said in the beginning, and see where plausibility breaks down. But I think the argument needs to be made. And, you know, in light of your question, I'm reminded of the way that Iamblichus answers Porphyry's question. So Porphyry asked this kind of question in the very beginning of book 3 of Iamblichus' De Mysteries. And he says, basically, like, how do we have knowledge of the gods, right? And then Iamblichus, because, you know, he's kind of, I don't know. It's difficult to get Iambicus writes letters, you know, and he has this one book which seems to be kind of weird in a way, the Dane Mysteries on the mysteries of Egypt. But here, the way he responds to Porphyry's question is like, oh, I can tell by the very fact that you asked your question that you're dumb. Like because if you knew, you know, in fact, we actually don't have knowledge of the gods, because knowledge implies a separation between that which is known and the knower. In fact, we are who we are by virtue of the knowledge of the gods, right? In a way, already in that shift, the way that Iambicus is thinking about knowledge, right? Knowledge is real knowledge, right? It's not something that Porphyry, in his horizontal-minded, this worldly thinking of knowledge, but knowledge is, in fact, seems to be an expression of divine ontology, of divine essence, essentially. And there, there already we kind of see this radical, it's not completely irrelevant, but this demotion of things like philosophy or discursive thought for the attaining of real, firm, complete, total panoptic knowledge, which Iambicus will go on to essentially define as prognosis, right? So in a way, what Iambicus is doing is trying to say that all instances of prognosis that happens in this world are essentially just reflections or representations of real divine thinking that happens at the realm of the intellect. And in that way, prognosis is an extension of divine knowing, as opposed to something that can be cleanly, it's not to us. We can't have prognosis. Just as humans, we just can't do it. And you know, that seems kind of odd, at least according to Peter Strzok, right? When we're thinking along the long arc of Greek and Roman notions of divination, which at least according to Strzok's kind of understanding of Strzok's understanding, you know, has typically been much more this worldly, practical. Like, should I get married to this person or not? Right? Should I go out on this war or not? Right? With Iambicus, as I think Strzok rightly argues, we've moved far past that. It's not a knowledge of individual events. It's about panoptic, total knowledge of all things. And here, I think this kind of comparison with the homilies and with the Manichaean stuff becomes fruitful. Because what if we think about Iambicus as part of a larger discursive moment, right? Then can we start thinking about homilies, you know, who is also coming from late antique Syria, essentially, and its concerns with prophecy and its concerns of prognosis. There's a scene in which the Apostle Peter is saying, exactly as you said, the Apostle Peter says something like, you would be completely mistaken if you thought that the diagnosis of a doctor is the same thing as divine prognosis, the prognosis that Jesus, the true prophet, has, right? He says this, like, they're completely not the same. Okay, you would be in great error. But then he says, but nevertheless, prediction is useful for me because it points to the existence of real prognosis. And what is real prognosis? You know, it is the complete knowledge of all things that Jesus, true prophet, has as an extension of the Holy Spirit that is coursing through him at all times. So that's the pseudo-Clementine homilies. With the Manichaean stuff, I think it kind of hinges on the questions of expectations that are now being set for these Manichaean teachers. You know, okay, well, if you were a Manichaean, then we kind of imagine them fully embedded within the world of late antique Syria and Mesopotamia, and there's people like the pseudo-Clementine homilies, and there's people like Iambicus, naturally, you would ask your teacher and say, okay, well, you know, well, how come you don't know what happened before the beginning? How come you don't know what happened after the end, right? How come you don't have knowledge of all these things of all times, right? And the Manichaeans seem to be kind of processing these kind of similar questions, and they're concerned, right? The text that I look at least in the book, a Manichaean disciple comes up to a teacher, well, Mani in this case, who is a stock historical, stock literary character, not a historical figure, right? He comes like, how come, you know, I am an elect, right? And I have the same light mind that you have, and you know everything, but how come I don't know everything? And then Mani gives a set of kind of like excuses why he doesn't know everything. But practically what that does is actually it delimits the boundaries of available revelatory knowledge for the community that is writing that text, right? Don't ask what happened before the beginning. Don't ask what happened after the end, right? But you can ask everything that's in between. But what I'm trying to say is that that pressure to kind of begin to articulate the boundaries of Manichaean prognosis might have emerged precisely because of people like Iamblichus and people like the people responsible for pseudo-Clement homilies, because they're talking about total knowledge of everything at all times, right?
And yeah.
Which is a fantasy, which is ultimately a fantasy.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense too.
Yeah. No, it's great. Your note about boundaries makes me want to ask a kind of concluding type question. As I was thinking about the book, I mean, so much of the book is about this emphasis on shared worlds, right? That like Manichaeans and Jews and Christians, they knew each other and they were living in the same world. It reminded me of the old Marcel Marsh argument that kind of our default assumption should be to assume that people shared ideas and habits. Like, the question isn't why cultural norms spread, it's why they don't. Lots of people in countries around China use chopsticks. The question is why don't people in Thailand, right? Or lots of people listen to Taylor Swift, but like, you know, we learn more when we ask why do some people not, like, why do some people hate that, right? Like, and I think your point with the, you know, Manichaean psalms sounding just like the Christian ones, or the kind of resonances that we hear a lot across this, is like, yeah, these were shared worlds. But I'm also thinking about this other line of scholarship that says, you know, sure, you know, John Chrysostom is going to, complain about Manichaeans, but like, are these like real people that he's talking with? Like, did he ever meet Manichaean? The more obvious one is with his critiques of Judaism, right? Like, you know, is this like a serious critique of something, or is he just like making a straw man? And usually it's the other, right? So can you think, to kind of talk us through how you were balancing this, you know, emphasis on shared worlds with the importance of, you know, rejections and boundary drawings to say like, you know, our group is different because we don't do this, you know, set of shared things.
Right. Great question. I mean, it's in a way, it's impossible to able to, you know, to know, you know, I think my beginning point was actually Ephraim, and I was reading, John Reeves, he has this article, which is called The Citations of Manichaean Books or something like that, in Ephraim's Prose Refutations and his Hymns Against the Heresies. And, there's a specific word in Syriac, at least, that can be used to mark like direct speech. And he kind of uses that as a window into seeing how every time that Ephraim seems to be citing what he heard or something from Mani's books. And it's very interesting for us because so much of the Aramaic literature of the Manichaean corpus has been lost. It's helpful for us to kind of reconstruct what might have been the original Aramaic words behind a lot of these talks. At least in Ephraim's case, I think he knows so much. You know, there in that case, at least, he knows so much, and in a way, he has to. Because Mani established a church like in Edessa. I know, you know, he was in Nisibis and then in Edessa, but Mani established a church in Edessa, I think like 20 years before Ephraim was even born or something like that. Like, you know, Mani was there before. And in a way, Ephraim is kind of entering to it, and he kind of seems to know a lot about the Manichaean church. I think your larger question, so what I'm trying to stress here is the necessity of kind of like local, you got to read the texts, right? And see what they actually know about him. But I wonder if I can kind of like flip your question, just, you know, perhaps is what opportunities arise for further inquiry if we assume that they didn't know one another? Like, how can we use that as an opportunity for further, in what ways might that actually be an interesting thing, right? I think one perhaps obvious way is that we can investigate the discourses of differentiation themselves, right? Clearly, when heresiologists are talking about heretics, we need to hold them, what they're saying about the heretics, in suspicion, right? Even though often they actually do have accurate descriptions of what heretics, quote unquote, heretics actually believe, right? And we need to kind of situate them in a larger framework of thinking about Christianity. But what we can do is actually parse out the strategies through which they are differentiating one from the other, and then contextualize those strategies as well. And in that case, it would be interesting that they don't know one another, because then it would be a case of saying, okay, actually, this community that hates this other community, right, are you know, they're differentiating themselves from that community in ways that might be actually very resonant with the way that that other community is differentiating themselves from the other community. So really, it comes down to this kind of similarity, a comparison of discursive strategies or attempts at differentiation. So for example, you can think of like rabbinic minute, right? Minim minute, right? In comparison to Christian emergence of heresiology, as scholars already have done, right? Or you can think about in terms, I'm sure people have done, maybe I just don't know, but, you know, Manichaean ways of separating themselves or distinguishing themselves, not just from the Baptists, but through like languages of ethnicity, through race, you know, it's all there as well. And shared modes of identification, right? So regardless of how well these communities knew one another, one can kind of see them as, again, kind of sharing in, potentially sharing in this common shared fund of discursive strategies. Or, you know, we can even think broader and say, actually, maybe these are not isolated emergences, but they're something like co-emergences. Like each tradition has a stock of resources. They have their own traditions in which they're trying to answer shared problems across different communities. And then we can kind of share this as kind of like, again, kind of putting them on the same plane of analysis and then saying that, oh, actually, in the same way that they're struggling with this problem, this community is struggling with the problem of communal boundaries or identity or whatever, right? The Manichaeans are doing something very similar. The Jews are something similar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In that way, you know, no group is privileged. No group becomes the standard norm for how we as scholars actually need to look into the past. But they're all available, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Okay. So, you know, there, of course, are a small but mighty group of Manichae scholars that no doubt will grow thanks to your work here. But for those of us who are not specialists here, you know, what do you hope a kind of non-specialist takes away from a book like this?
As I said in the very beginning, you know, I'm trying to recruit scholars in adjacent fields for intensive, you know, looking at this corpus. You know, there's a lot here that one can do. I'm trying to make this like an invitation for, please look at them. You know, please look at these texts. They're very interesting. Again, number one is the shared utility of this corpus for adjacent fields, you know, further opportunities for collaboration across different fields. And perhaps mostly, you know, the potential for new and more interesting narratives and trajectories for thinking about, I don't know, Christianity, for thinking about heresy or Sasanian Mesopotamia or the Roman Empire or the emergence of liturgy or, you know, homiletical styles or, you know, or various forms of textuality. All of those things can be fruitfully explored, compared and incorporated with an eye towards the Manichaean corpus as well. Yeah, that's what I would say.
Great, thanks. Yeah. All right, and last question. What are you working on now?
I'm working on emails. It's all my emails. And I'm working on my second project, in which case throughout this entire, you know, time that I've been talking, I'm trying to really just kind of concretely lay out the utility, as I said before, why this corpus could be very helpful for the ways that rabbinicists think about late antiquity, scholars of Christianity look at the development of liturgy, thinking about the Colomani Codex as an apocryphal act in and of itself, although it's never included in the standard five, not standard five, the great five, or however you want to call it, to kind of play around with those questions to show how this corpus kind of unsettles established habits in the hope of unearthing something new, something more interesting, something more creative. Yeah.
Great. Well, that sounds good. You know, maybe we can talk about that when that project's done too. Jay, thank you for being here. This was fun. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.